People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by FoundItemClothing.com. Check out their Cthulhu slippers and cool cult film t-shirts. Edited and produced by D.B. Spitzer. Featuring Sarah Fee and D.B. Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. PGTTCM is part of the Dark Mists Network. Check out all the cool podcasts that we like at darkmyths.org. Subscribe where you subscribe. Like where you like. Rate where you rate. We recommend podbean.com and Apple Podcasts as well. Find PGTTCM on social media at PGTTCM and on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. If you want to donate, go to the Patreon button on pgttcm.podbean.com or paypal.me/pgttcm. All donations receive an on-air congratulations. Shop at pgttcm.threadless.com or pgttcm.com at the shop. PGTTCM is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos, weird fiction, the gothic literary tradition, classic sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. Thank you. On with the show.
Section 9 of Tales of the Uneasy by Violet Hunt. Read by Lisa Reichert. The Blue Bonnet. A little spark in a blue bonnet who fought like the devil at Preston. Boswell. The tourists peered past the grey stone pillars of the gateway into the courtyard, paved with round cobbles, grass grown in between. The low sculptured doorway gave admittance to the old manor house that had so fascinated the lady of the party from the first moment she had cast eyes on it. "Oh, this is a bit of the real thing!" she had exclaimed fervently, when 5 miles out of Richmond the road had ceased to follow the course of the swale, mantled all the way with heavy oak and hazel copses. They seemed to hang like heavy beards from the beetle-browed face of the cliffs that shelter the east bank of the river. "The very real thing!" she had continued, as the wagonette turned out into the open moorland, and their town-bleached cheeks were bathed at once in the pure, sullen airs that roamed over it, softened and suffused with the tears of an April storm gone by. "This is the real Yorkshire moor I've heard of, bare and empty, with not a single dwelling to be seen. Yes, there's one." For as their conveyance dived down into the scarp of a hill, she sighted beyond the now familiar river which wound again into view, directly crossing their path, and the low bridge of quite modern construction which spanned it, the square mass of a house commanding the river bank. It seemed to stand bulldog-like on the slight acclivity, posing as guardian of the ford at that place, which was certainly all that had served for crossing 100 years ago. So her instructive companion remarked to the eager lady. She grew more and more enthusiastic. "John, I can't possibly pass it. I couldn't reconcile it with my historical conscience to go by without an attempt to see it. It's like a grey-haired woman standing stranded on the edge of the world, an old Ariadne of a house, waiting forever by the side of the flood. Ask the driver what they call it."
"Walburn Old Hall," said the stolid Yorkshireman, flicking a fly off his horse's ear.
3 blind, hopeless windows, which had been closed up for the tax, looked over the old garden garth. The eyes of the persons looking thence could have swept the stream and the narrow neck which formed the ford. The stone-flagged courtyard of the house was enclosed by buildings on all sides but one. On the west, looking towards the river, was a ruined battlement on which a man might still walk and survey the country round for miles. But it was now insecure, the inner rubble exposed. Clumps of wild mustard and garlic sprang from every cranny and crevice, and made a yellow blaze that lit up the grey substance of the pile. The lady, unable to contain herself longer, requested the driver to pull up and let them have a look. Her companion took out a guide-book and read aloud as they sat in the brake in the streaming sunshine.
"Walburn Old Hall, fortified manor house, dismantled."
"I should think it was."
"A poor cause. The old cause of all. Listen. Family of Donay. There's the shield on the door, evidently. See all that repoussé work? Only we can't read it from here. The book says, "The ancient family of Donnay, who beareth Sable Gulty, Argent, and a Canton ermine." Yes, Guy Donnay's tomb is in the church at Redmire, remember it? His feet are cased in brass-toed solarets. Above his lady's head are three shields of arms. She appears to have been a Conyers. Well, they seem to be pretty well extinct now. The last Donnay was out and killed in the 15. There were Donnays in the Great Rebellion, Donnays in the Gunpowder Plot, in the Rising in the North. Poor romantic dears. Yes, that's the plague of lost causes. They swayed the emotions so forcibly, and through the emotions, the very lives of the old families, those that had any good in them. One imagines them, up to the very latest day, having an indistinct glimmering of their own original raison d'etre, that is, lands given in exchange for service. Their modern representatives have lost even the glimmering. Well, oughtn't we to be driving on?
Oh, no. After what you've been making out, I must have a try to see over it. I want to make out that blurred shield over the door. Ghouls Argent and Canton Ermine, was it? They can but refuse us.
The young couple alighted under mute protest from the driver and entered the courtyard, the lady bold, the man nervous, deprecating. They received forthwith a Teniers-like vision of an interior. Farmhands were sitting round a wooden table, placed in the oak-panelled, greasy blackness of a low-raftered hall. All looked up and ceased pulling at their mugs. A frowsy young girl of 18, wiping her mouth, came forward.
"Could we see over?" The glint of a silver coin in the lady's hand pleasingly accentuated her request.
A voice came from the interior as the girl stood hesitating and shy.
"Mind, hinny, thou'st not take the lady anywhere it isn't safe. Keep out of the room the captain's leg came through. And mind, the stairway beyant isn't much to crack on."
The girl, thus admonished, turned and led the enthusiastic pair in and up the rich darkness of the stair.
"That's the best part of it. Her mother told her to leave out," whispered the lady. "That about the captain's leg. It sounds most exciting. Ask her, or I will."
The girl, questioned, replied over her shoulder.
"It's a tale, ma'am. A long while back it were, ages and ages, they do say a man's leg came through the floor, and he's always called the captain. The boards is rotten just there, and was then. That whole end of the house is fair gone to powder. My grandfather used to say that a man's leg made it coming through. But it was long before this time, and he was a very old man. The ceilings of that part of the house is that powdery, would you believe it, that we can always scrape the plaster and get a bit for baby."
"How funny and utilitarian! And is it haunted?"
"Grandfather always said 'twas."
"Who by?"
"They do say a poor man went clean daft there, came home and found every one lying dead about the place."
"But what had they died of? Plague?"
"The smit? Naw. Grandfather always said 'twere a tragedy, same as they has in the papers nowadays."
"Where's your grandfather now?"
She jerked her finger over towards the north.
"Churchyard. But he knew all about this place. His father before him was ostler about the inn at Redmire. You'll pass it on your way to Bolton. He always said there was a hiding hole here, and more'n that, a secret way. But teacher says that's all nonsense, and we mustn't waste our time looking for it. Besides, it isn't safe. We shut up this part, and just pack into the other, where it's still pretty good. And at Michaelmas we've all got to go out, and Lord Scrope is going to pull the old place down."
"Shame!"
"Oh, I dunno. It's fair rotten."
"Are you sure you can't take us into the rotten part, just for once, before it all goes?"
"That I cannot. The worst room is the one the man's leg came through. They call it the Lady Christina's room, and it's there grandfather says the priest's hole was."
"It was generally out of the principal room in the house," said the man. "They wanted him under their own hand, and to be able to feed him at night. Come along, Mary, you really can't see it."
"I suppose not," she sighed. "But I do somehow seem to see Christina, the Lady Christina. I suppose her spirit is about? Why, lady? The Donnays had no title."
"These people always dignify ghosts and raise them to the peerage. Let's see if we can't make up a story for her. Christina Daunet and her lover. Was he the man who went mad, or the priest she hid?
They were descending the stairs. Their cicerone broke in suddenly.
Nay, that weren't the way. The real heir was troth plight to the Lady Christina, and he was drowned one day here in the ford, here under her very eyes.
Another touch, said her companion eagerly. So legend grows. Let us go and sit on the hill here and look towards the ford, and I'll try to reconstruct her story for you. I'm not a novelist for nothing. This is how the man went mad when he came home.
There was no priest. The lover was that little spark in a blue bonnet that fought at Preston Boswell speaks of. I've always wanted to connect him up with a story. Miss Christina Daunet, not lady, was tall and pale and a fine girl so long as she had enough to eat and nothing to brood on. But her adolescence and greatest need of nourishment happened to coincide with Jacobite times of stress, when loyal subjects starved in order that the Stuarts might come by their own. The females of her family were used, even hardened, to the more domestic consequences of the male's unfaltering loyalty. When the fuss was about priests, Christina's own grandmother had successfully concealed one in the hiding place in her room, that very room that we were not permitted to investigate, looking towards the ford and the road to Richmond. Today her own mother lay there, 80, bedridden, daft and doited. These two women were the widow and daughter of the last Daunet of the direct line. Since the great Guy of the Canton Ermine, the race had continually dwindled. So many of them had been strangled, so many hanged and drawn and quartered. A half dozen desiccated heads belonging to the strain had rotted on Temple Bar. Cold steel and a touch of poison had been responsible for some others, and thus the foolish, forlorn race had been cleared off to make room for persons of finer judgment and less realistic ideals. Acts of attainder, recusant fines, had impoverished their estates and mulcted them of their goods, till of all the broad lands, castles, and noble manor houses that had bred and sheltered and maintained Daunets for the king's service, only the austere, embattled farmhouse at the Richmondshire moors remained, and therein the two women that alone bore the fine fighting name slowly pined and withered away. They had not enough to eat, yet their appetites were no larger than feminine appetites are reputed to be. Sir Christopher Daunet, Christina's father, was killed at Sheriffmuir when his little daughter was a year old, and her mother, grown doited with the shock, lived on to give very little trouble and represent no great charge on the family finances. She lay always in her big room in the southwest wing, her heavy four-post bed, too mighty and perhaps too rotten to be moved, remained firm in its old place on the safer part of the flooring. The tester was hung by heavy rings to the ceiling. Her daughter, ministering to her slight wants, had learned to walk warily round the bed. Christina Daunet was loyal, as women are loyal. She realized very fairly that this task of the reinstatement of the Stuart dynasty on the throne of England had been set by Providence on her and hers, incidentally carrying with it the doom of extermination set on the race. Their blind inherent loyalty clustered as it must round the losing side, which sucked in naturally these people who always went where their advantage was not, and the losing side had drawn in her father, her uncle, even the man she loved. She loved her cousin, Charles Daunet of Scanwood. Scanwood House lay 3 miles hence on the Richmond Road. Charles was the only son of her father's only sister. Christina and this young man were early troth-plighted. They were about to wed. But the Stuarts came first. It was the cause that intervened and forbade the innocent bands. Charles Daunet allowed the just impediment and went out as a matter of course. He was more eager for the day of the stranger's crowning than for the morn that should usher in his wedding with Christina, whom he knew and loved. He had left her too easily. Folk in the neighborhood said he was slack.
Christina herself admitted that Charles was more of a fighter than a lover. But the Stuarts called. What was Adonai to do? She cried sometimes and mourned over her balked betrothal with her only confidant, a certain Luc Daunet. Her father had had a son, but he was not her mother's child. Luc lived with them. His mother had been innkeeper's daughter over at Redmire, a good girl enough till Sir Christopher Daunet came her way. He lived so near, at Walburn, and he was not the man to leave so fair a flower ungathered. Madame Daunet was not a hard woman. She undertook the child's maintenance when its mother died and Sir Christopher fell at Sheriffmuir. Luc grew up. He was not all there, but he was an honest, kindly, gentle fellow, and for the two lonely women he did a man's work about the place. There was not much to do. There was not a beast left in the stable except a wall-eyed, knock-kneed pony that Luc rode into Redmire or Marsk now and then to buy necessaries. They could afford no other servant. The white-handed, proud Christina tended her mother, cooked, and did the inside work of the house. It was all one. When the prince should come into his own, Christina would do so likewise. Of that she had doubts sometimes, especially when the wind whistled over the moor, and the stream ran heavy and turbid below the garden, so that the ford was ill to cross. The prince's final triumphing then seemed surer than her own. Charles had been away now a long while. He had not been assiduous about her for many months before his departure to join the prince. He had sent her no message, first or last. She had even heard of another lady. For rumours flew. The news of the brief Stuart apotheosis at Edinburgh, tidings of the prince's meteoric courts at Holyrood, had filtered down to Redmire and the bar of the inn there. Preston fight, too, was mentioned. She thought, but was not sure, that Charles had been noticed there. Now the prince was marching south, had marched. On that day of December, mild and calm and presageless as it seemed, Christina was ill at ease, peevish, apprehensive. She went about the house place and courtyard with her ears pricked to the free-roving wind that might have brushed her Charles's bonnet in passing as he marched south with his troops. Or, weary of this fairy listening, she would droop her eyes till they rested dreaming on the waterway below the dip of the hill where Walburn Hall stood. Then she would raise them slowly to look a little higher on the level where the turrets of Scanwood were just visible, nestling in their encompassing woods. Scanwood was a fine place, and would it be hers some day? Puzzling like a fox that is hunted, she snuffed the air and could not tell which way danger, or perhaps bliss, might come. Had the prince's army passed them on its way south? For indeed the last news Luc had brought had been that the Stuart heir was marching on his own capital, with his victorious rabble of Highlanders. King George was quaking. Would not Charles, if this were so, have to pass by Scanwood to see to his domestic concerns? Her mother babbled forever of drums. The old woman would have it that she heard them. "They've gone by, my dear, they've gone by. Oh, the bonny lads! The prince has gone into England, never to leave it again, dearie. Listen to the old doited woman, for she speaks truth. Rub-a-dub, rub-a-dub." "Whisht, whisht, mother," Christina now and again murmured softly, but not imperatively, as she stood by the window and herself, with her slight long fingers, performed the manoeuvre known as drumming on the pane. Yes, her heart lifted. He had passed, at a point perhaps miles away, too far for him to get leave to call in and see his sweetheart. She must have patience. One day soon she would be looking out of this very window, and she would see Charles on his fine horse, crossing the ford at the old place, coming to her, with a light heart and all his troubles and hers behind him, cast aside, healed, over and done with. She could discern the very spot now where the bottom was nearest and the water shallowest, even exposed at times in drought. The waters flowed glumly over it now, There had been much rain to swell them. Sometimes, to the excited girl who stood there, her nerves wrought by the faint, vocal rub-a-dubbing that came from the bed behind her, it seemed that the water gathered itself up into shapes, shapes of horses and men. The little waves seemed to rise obediently under the harsh wind and form themselves into the semblance of uncanny humanity. They massed themselves and menaced, yes, she came to fancy that one figure rose again and again from the sullen flow to shake a quivering fist at her. She stared the silly vision down. Soon the water ran by as usual, huddling, lumping itself into small ridges under the wind, but nothing so tall as a man. She turned to receive and divert the mother's peevish voice. The old woman had ceased to imitate the drums. She was now convinced in her senile way they had passed. She talked strange nonsense, used strange names.
Bound for the south they are. The bridge, Swarkstone. Swarkstone.
Where's that, mother?
Bad luck, bad luck, the bridge. No further, Swarkstone, no further. Back, back. I'm cold, Christina, I'm cold.
The day's changing, and you feel it, said Christina sadly, altering the position of the coverings. It was all she could do.
Nay, 'tis the smit of death I've got, Christina. I know it.
Oh, mother, not now, just when we are going to be so happy. But her heart did not back her words. Look here, I'll have Luke go to Redmere at once and get you some of Betty Candlish's cordial. She promised me some for you the moment I wanted it, and you seemed low as you do today. We won't let you die just yet.
Aye, but can you keep me? Said the voice from the bed gently. It's that I've got, and no mistake. I've felt it all day. Come back and kiss me, Christina. You're a good girl, a very good girl. The bridge at Swarkstone. I saw him there, the prince. Remember that, Christina?
Yes, mother, I will, though I never heard of such a place in my life, cajoled the girl as she went downstairs to seek the half-witted Luke and confide her errand to him. He sat, as usual, on the oak settle, swallowed up in the glooms of the chimney corner. She roused him up and told him what she wanted. She helped him to saddle the pony and watched him potter slowly up the hill towards Bolton. Then she re-entered the house and cut up, on the corner of the big seamed oaken table, some vegetables which she had fetched from an outhouse. Into a pot on the fire she threw the sliced turnips and carrots. There was not much fire to hang over, but her forehead got hot, her cheeks flushed, and her hair escaped a little from its binding. Presently, having put the mess to one side on the hob, she walked slowly out into the courtyard to get air, of which she suddenly felt a violent need. She languidly ascended the few broken steps that led up to the old battlement. At that time one could still walk along it without having one's attention too much distracted by the necessity of picking one's way among the rubble. She strolled backwards and forwards, enjoying the fresh moorland air that caressed her reddened cheeks and blew her pale yellow hair away in an easterly direction. Holding her hand to her forehead instinctively to restrain it, though there was no one to be seen for miles, she scanned the country to the south. Her blue eyes roved over the low rolling hills that let her see a very long way, but not as far as that bridge at Swarkstone, 6 miles south of Derby, where the lines of her fate had been converging for several days past, and were now radiating away from thence in ragged streaks and strands of fugitive soldiers and brutal, complacent pursuers. She was overcome with a sudden trepidation, a rush of feeling that somehow impelled her to get back to the room where her mother lay, and see for herself how the helpless woman was getting on. But she sat down on the parapet, which, at the point where she was, still stood firm at the side of the battlement next to the road. Overcome by a sudden faintness, she hid her face in her hands. She had eaten very little that day. Her back was to the road, and her eyes, should she uncover them, would have rested on the empty grass-grown courtyard. It was not empty. A noise like a dead leaf twisting startled her. Luke come back on foot, without the pony.
She had pressed her knuckles into her eyes until her eyes had grown hazy and suffused, and it was a second or two before she saw there was actually a man in the courtyard below her. A man, not Luke. His bonnet, faded by sun and wind and rain, had once been blue. She heard his breath that came quickly, and very dryly, scenting a beggar and a demand for alms, she asked him his business. He raised his drooping head.
"Charles!"
"Christina, quick! Who else is here? Can you harbor me?"
"What? What?"
"I come from Derby, the route at Derby. We got 6 miles beyond and turned back. I am pursued. Quick, can you hide me? Will you? They will search my house at Scanwood. They are there now."
Christina was not looking at him. She had half turned when he spoke of Scanwood, and her eyes pried into the bosky mazes lying between. The fugitive thought that the brusque movement had its occasion in a natural change in her sentiments towards him. He deserved no better. He had practically deserted her. He had never written. A woman scorned. Yet in his urgent necessity, he must needs appeal to her again.
"Christina, an answer, I beg of you. Shall I go further for a shelter?"
"Take off that cap. Reach it up to me here. Now go into the chimney corner, you know it. Sit down at ease. Not another word."
While speaking, she had taken the blue cap and flung it down into the chapel garth on the other side of the wall. The cluster of ramps and fronds of wild garlic parted and opened to receive it and came together again. Meantime, such was the power of insistence in her voice that the fugitive obeyed her as he would obey the military word of command. Heavily walking over the stones of the courtyard, he took his place on the settle in the chimney nook and crossed his legs negligently. He could still see Christina standing on the battlement looking down towards the ford. She stood first on one leg and then on the other. She agitated her body strangely. She made signs. Then faint sounds, voices, the clink of bridles came to his ears from the direction in which she looked. His pursuers, most likely, for the noise came from Scanwood. He stretched his legs, stiff from 2 nights' exposure, further out in an attitude of ease as she had bidden him. He did not know what Christina meant to do. She was revengeful. Then she would give him up? She meant perhaps to save him? Well, his life belonged to her. He waited. 5 minutes ago, Christina had seen his enemies taking the ford, a well-found troop of horse, and a stoutish personable man riding at their head. Charles Daunet from the ingle nook could not see them, but he could see his Christina make a trumpet of her white hands, and hear her bawl, yes, bawl to them over the battlement.
"Good gentlemen, hear me. Will you please to take some refreshment? I cannot allow you to go by me, for it is lonely here at Walburn Hall."
"Is that what you call it?" said a clear voice. "Wheel, men!"
Charles Daunet saw the speaker ride into the little courtyard at the head of his troop and dismount. He was a fine, florid man of 40 or so. He wore a high, fixed cap, with upon it the white horse of Hanover. His gaiters were white, and at his saddle he carried a dead turkey. Christina had descended from the battlement and had gone to the horse's head. The man spoke breezily.
"Captain Butler at your service, mistress. We will eat a crust with you, the more so because we come to search you in the king's name."
"Do you say so?" Christina replied, setting the tone of the interview in a way that made Charles Daunet shiver. "Come you then in the king's name. George or James, 'tis all the same to me, a woman. It's long enough since a man came this way. I was wearying for the sight of one."
The captain laughed heartily. "Business first, miss, if you please. We have a warrant to take a certain Colonel Charles Daunet of Scanwood, who fought for the Pretender at Preston, and gave us honest ones a dance of it."
Christina looked faintly bored. "My cousin of Scanwood. Is he not at home?"
"We have spent 2 hours ferreting for him there, and the housekeeper bade us come here. She said he was a good friend of yours."
"She is chary of her information," said the girl composedly. "I was more than a friend. I was once sweethearts with him, for my sins.
but I have no care for the fellow now." She tossed her head. "Come in, come in, you and your men, as many as the roof will shelter. The wine cask is low, but we will do what we can. I am alone here, nearly.
My men, some of them, must search the house."
"Ay, let them search closely. I was always one for formality. But see, they take heed of the flooring of the upper rooms, which is indifferent and might let one of them through, especially if he be a fine man like yourself, Captain." She giggled. "Shall I go along with them and indicate the places where the maggots cling and the mouse gnaws and all is gone to fine powder?"
"No, they must shift as best they can. And you shall stay here and talk with me. Our man should be here without your knowledge, perhaps, since you say you and he have fallen out?"
"We fell out," said Christina carelessly, "when he chose to leave me to go and fight for a man I had never seen and didn't care for. He should have stayed here and taken care of his own."
"I am with you, mistress. Little as he is, though, he fought us like the devil at Preston. His blue bonnet was everywhere, and he fairly swinging our poor fellows. The Duke is wild to have him strung up. Well, men, off with you. Thoroughly, mind, every corner. Is there a cursed hiding hole here?"
"Yes, in my mother's room," said the hostess languidly. "She lies there bedridden. Speak her fair and gently, and she will instruct you to find the way in. On the left-hand side of the fireplace, a bolt shaped like a beetle. Only it's iron, and if Charles is there, so much the worse for him."
"You've got the spirit, nasty at that. Well, let's in. 'Tis hot, and your liquor comes not amiss."
Christina led the way under the low-browed doorway to the kitchen, where Charles Daunet was sitting. She made straight for the corner where he was, and, lifting up a wooden flap of the settle, rummaged for a bottle of spirits. Aloud she said,
"Get thy great foot out of the way, Luke, wilt ta?"
"Aye, who's that?" asked Captain Butler, apprehending the sullen inmate of the chimney corner for the first time.
That's a poor foolish cousin of mine," she replied, rising from her knees with the bottle, a little flushed with stooping.
"You seem full of cousins."
"Yes, but this one's on the wrong side of the blanket. He's not over quick, but he'll answer a civil question, no doubt. Now then," she took Charles Daunet roughly by the wounded shoulder, and he winced. "Look up. Speak to the captain, can't you?"
"What's your name?" asked that personage humorously, entering into the spirit of the thing, but he got no answer. Christina shrugged her shoulders. "Truth, he's got no name by the rights of it, or if he has, it's the same as mine. Luke Daunet, at your service."
"Drat you, Luke, why don't you stand up and speak for yourself?"
Still the man on the settle did not move.
"He's taken that way sometimes, Captain, a fit of the sullens, as obstinate as a mule, and you can't get a word out of him. And another day he'll rattle away fit to drive you. Poor sort of company for a girl like me. We just have to give him house room and a bite and a sup now and then for kinship's sake."
She poured out a glass of mead, and the captain took up the glass and raised it to his lips.
"A kiss before I drink."
He put his hand on her shrinking shoulder. The kiss lit on her ear. The man in the corner looked up sharply.
"Be quiet, Luke. Don't you see I never gave it?" she said, as if to a froward, jealous baby.
"It isn't to his taste, eh?" said Butler. "Ha, ha!"
"Never you mind his tantrums, Captain. We never take any notice, Mother and I."
She filled his glass again. He sat down near the end of the table. She made shift to sweep the fragments of vegetables away with the carroty knife, but the Captain raised his hand.
"Let be," he said. "Come and sit here, if this surly fellow will permit it. I shall like to watch his face."
He put his burly arm out, and not before she knew what she was doing, proud Christina Daunet was sitting on the trooper's knee and playing with his beard. There was a sound of feet and much stamping overhead. Presently, with a sharp, ugly crash of splintering timber, the booted leg of one of Butler's men came through the ceiling and dangled helplessly. Christina jumped off the captain's knee and burst out laughing.
"There! I told you 'twould happen!"
"Bravo, Tim Jobling! I'd know his leg in a hundred.
"'Gad, I can hear him squealing like a pig up there!'
"'Tis in my mother's room,' exclaimed Christina suddenly. "'Twill frighten her to death!'
"'You shan't go till they come down. They'll be here directly. Look you, it's all right now. Tim Jobling has gotten back his leg. They have him by the shoulders and hoist him up so. He's still swearing, though I can't hear. You shall hear me roast him.'
Christina did not sit on his knee again, but leaped away with a coquettish grimace as the members of the search party came downstairs. Sheepishly came Tim Jobling at the tail of the group, minded to avoid Butler's merriment.
"'Found naught, Captain, except one doited old woman in bed.'
"'My mother!' interposed Christina proudly.
"'Aye, Walters, keep a civil tongue in your head. It can do you no harm. Did you put your blade through the bed?'
"'We did, aye. The old body sat up and talked gibberish. She frightened poor Tim, that he stepped back sharp and threw the flooring.'
"'His leg came out just there,' said Butler, pointing to the comminuted fracture of laths and planks that sagged down from the ceiling. "'Well, Tim, you're no worse, and you've given me and my young lady here very good amusement. Your leg wagged like a mouse's tail in a trap. My word! Well, well, there's meetings and there's partings, mistress.' We'll have to be jogging away. Our man's still to seek.
What's this place, Redmire? He spoke to Christina, taking her by the chin.
It's a lost sort of place, 3 miles away from here. Marsk's a deal more likely. Yet why should I be helping you to catch the poor escaped fellow? You'll hang him, I'll warrant, and though he's despised me, I don't wish him that much harm. I was never fond of telling the hunt which way the fox had gone.
Do you say so?
He looked judicial and stroked his beard. After a pause, "'Still, I'll just have the correct name of that place you mentioned. You've no call to be careful for Charles Scanwood. He's given you the go-by, you say. A man merits a rope for neglecting a pretty wench, over and above being punished for the hell he gave us all at Preston. That blue bonnet of his was like the clout of the devil himself. Well, well, adieu. Thank you for your mead.' And if ever I'm this way again.
Go, since go you will, said she. I shall see or speak to no man but you here this side of Lady Day. So, Captain, farewell. Grant me a favor?
Ask it.
My cousin here.
Sulky face, aye.
He's got business for me in Marsk. The ford's swollen. We have no horse. Let him ride behind one of your men so far. You're going to Marsk to look for Scanwood?
Certainly, miss, we'll oblige. Tim Jobling shall take him behind. Come, men, saddle. We must be off.
Give me a letter, so that the next company passes this way, don't trouble me, she said. He scribbled something in a pocket-book and tore it out. She took it. Another glass before you go?
I'll not say no to that. Here's to King George. Will you toast him?
She drank it down. Just a good excuse to get a drink, she said.
Right. Women have no call to meddle with politics. And your cousin?
You can try him, but I fear he's stubborn. These sullen fits last for days. Here, Luke, drink to please me and the kind captain.
She held the cup to his mouth and whispered, Return here as soon as may be. Aloud she sneered, Look you, the great baby. He is suffering me to spill the good liquor. His lips are close shut.
Waste no more time on that lout that will not drink when a lady begs him, the captain said.
He wiped his lips.
Well, goodbye then. You were so glad to see me, you'll not refuse me a kiss at parting.
What are you thinking of, Captain Butler? She minced affectedly. And before your men, too.
Be hanged, my men. They're busy getting off. You're the prettiest picking I've seen since I left my barracks at Hounslow. And I cannot leave it unkissed.
He forced his lips. The man in the chimney corner stirred.
Touches him nearly, said Butler, whose eyes shone. I could do with another, given freely. Maybe if we were alone.
She shook her head.
No good, eh? Your promise, madam, was finer than your performance, but I am a gentleman. Come, my lob, lie by the fire, stump up.
The man in the ingle nook, with one reproachful glance at Christina, rose. He tottered a little and appeared dazed. Captain Butler, in sudden haste to be gone, clapped him on the back.
Come, my dear fellow, don't keep us waiting. We're bound to catch our gallows bird before dark.
The haggard eyes of the fugitive were fixed now on Christina and now on the stained kitchen knife that lay on the table.
It's the money, she said hastily. I was forgetting. Opening a shabby little leather bag that hung at her girdle, she produced a silver coin. Here, take it, Luke, for all that Betty Clandish would have given us credit. There goes. Don't drop it, you daft goneril. And mind, you'll have to come back by the bridge up Marsk way, for these kind gentlemen won't be coming back, I fancy. It's saving him a matter of 2 miles, Captain, thanking you kindly, and my mother pining for her drops.
The troopers in the yard were all mounted now, their bridles clinking, their horses pawing. Christina standing by Captain Butler's stirrup, bickering with him gaily to the last, watched her lover out of the corner of her eye as he doggedly passed out and hoisted himself up behind the man called Tim. He seemed woefully stiff. Christina supposed him to have a hurt somewhere, or was it merely the result of 2 nights' exposure? If it was the former, she promised herself a month's delicious nursing. Yet not a look did he cast in her direction as he rode away, uncovered, leaving one of Luke's old caps which she had reached down from a nail for him on the table beside the kitchen knife and the carrot scrapings. She saw it when she went in again. His negligence of any head covering must have looked odd and indifferent, but then his sullen and cross demeanor had tallied exactly with her account of him. She was proud of the part she had played. Yet the first thing she did when the sounds had died away was to catch up the rough cloth, not over clean, that lay there and rub her lips with it till the blood came. Then she sat down for a little while with her head buried in the selfsame cloth, crouching low in shame, remembering bitterly the indignities to which she had submitted in order to secure her false lover's safety. Half an hour she sat like this. Then the old clock in the corner struck wheezily. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She remembered her mother. She ought to go and see and comfort the old woman. Perhaps the rough troopers had frightened her. Heavy-footed, hating herself, loving Charles, she ascended the crazy stairs. The troopers had frightened her mother indeed. She was dead. The daughter, dry-eyed, left alone with death, did what was necessary. She washed the body of her beloved and dressed it and laid her arms across her breast with a little sprig of marjoram out of her garden between the fingers and covered up the cracked, dim looking-glass with a fair white cloth. She went downstairs and procured a plateful of salt, which she laid on the dead woman's chest to fend off the evil spirits. She drew down the blinds of the windows that looked out over the garden onto the ford, and sat down near the horribly yawning hole in the floor to await Luke or Charles. Neither of them might come for a good hour or more. She did not know which would be the first. Charles might not come for days, but when he did, he would be of good comfort and grateful to her for saving his life, at the expense, though it were, of half an hour's desperate but not irremediable degradation. It was nothing to her, considering the result, perhaps as little to him, and yet more than once during the ordeal she had fancied he was on the point of interposing and forbidding, at the risk of his life, the desecration of the lips that were his, and his only. He might not, perhaps, be willing to kiss her. No matter, she would dress his wound and shelter him and be a mother, not a mistress, to him a while. He had not slept in a bed, nurse tended by kind white hands, since Preston fight. He would kiss the hands sometimes, so she dreamed. About 5 o'clock she heard the thud of a horse's hoofs, trotting briskly towards her from the ford. Charles had been in luck, and somehow or other managed to get hold of a horse. She ran down, leaping, in her haste to go the nearest way, over the gaping chasm that shelved in like the hangman's drop in the middle of the floor. "My beloved!" A man stood, sheepish, in the house place. It was Captain Butler. "You!" she stammered and reeled.
"Yes, 'tis I, poor fool, come back to know more of you and your wiles, my beauty. For that you are, and may be, now that I've given my men the slip for an hour, You'll let me have that kiss."
Christina was holding on to the high back of the settle.
"Aye, there's no doubt about it. You're a gay piece, and no one would call you kissing shy. I like it. But that poor lad who sat there, he couldn't stomach so much freedom, I fancy. You made his poor heart ache and lost him his wits now, wasn't it? Well, well, he's the best judge of his own feelings. Maybe he's as well out of this troublesome world."
"What do you mean, Captain?"
"Only that that cousin of yours slipped off from behind Tim Jobling crossing the ford, and he was washed away almost before we in the front knew what was happening. It's my belief he did it on purpose."
"Drowned? Charles?"
"Is that his silly name? I thought you mentioned some other. He said something to Tim, I believe, before he let go."
"What was it?"
"Oh, if you care to hear, he said that he found the woman he loved was no better than a harlot, and he didn't care for his life any more since 'twas so. He just slipped off behind."
"And didn't anyone lift a finger to help him?" she wailed.
"Couldn't, I tell you. He was a deal too quick for Tim, seeing as he did it a purpose. No, miss, make no bones about it. His death lies at your door."
She tottered, and he held out a clumsy hand.
"Come, put it all behind you. Why should a fine girl like you sorrow for a half-witted yokel like that? You broke his heart, but what right had he to cast those bleary eyes of his on you? You are for a better than he. Come now, be pleasant. You didn't used to look bashful. One would think it was a different woman I've come back to. You're handsome enough, though, in all conscience, even with that face of thunder on you. Will you or won't you, Mistress Dunay? Will you come to me, my pretty?"
He took a pull at the stoup of liquor that was where he had put it down, and held out his arms. Still the woman stood, dazed, dumbfounded, her ordinarily quick brain acting slowly. She began to realize, by a series of successive shocks, that there was no one left to be helped or saved by diplomacy. She kept her distance, still eyeing the dark, wet knife on the table. She spoke at last, somber, taciturn.
"My mother lies dead upstairs."
"Does she so? Well, 'twas her time to die, wasn't it? We'll bury her decently. Come."
He sat there, glorying in his work, his legs well apart, smiling fatuously, waiting for the fair, sulky girl to forget her immediate griefs and fall on his neck for solace and comfort.
"Dawdling, playing the maiden, eh? You'll come in the end. What if your mother is dead? 80, I think she was. Trooper Tim gave her a fright, finished her off."
He was slightly drunk.
"I've left my men at Scanwood. I fancy its master is likely to seek the old earths after all. Come, still thinking on your mother? Devil, don't I tell you she was old and ripe for death? We'll give her Christian burial and do all things in order."
He fumbled in his pockets, and Christina's hand made a quick outward movement.
"And will you bury me decently too?" said she, advancing at last.
With the dignity of a queen, she sat down on the knee of the amorous captain, who fancied the hour of surrender had come. Indeed, he had some small excuse for thinking so, for with a gesture of abandonment, she flung one long arm round his neck.
"Aye, but don't strangle me," he whispered, his chin buried in her bare neck.
Christina's other hand was busy at his coat lapel. She found the place just over the collarbone. She had no science, but she just happened on it, and drove the long kitchen knife in straight. Its work was not done then. With an effort, she drew the knife out and used it again. Captain Butler, before he fell off the chair, saw her eyes glazing, and for one moment held a dead woman in his arms.
"And that, I think, was the way it was," said the romancer to his patient listener, as they sat together on the bare hillside, sloping to the bridge on the other side of the ruined battlement,
and let their hands run through the cool, straggling grasses that clothed its sad bleakness a little. He raised his hand, that had been fumbling negligently in the ground beside him.
"Look here, a daffodil! This must have been poor Christina Daunet's garden."
End of section 9.